Well, hey everyone, great news. The Groove Washer record cleaners are back in stock in limited numbers. After a brief COVID pause, the Groove Washer team has made available some stock online. Go to groovewasher.com and pick up one of the world's greatest record cleaners while they last. This COVID crisis has been tough on everyone, especially artists, the record stores, and the vinyl record industry. Get yourself an American-made product at groovewasher.com, manufactured in good old Kansas City, Missouri, or Missouri, as my dad used to say. The Groove Washer family not only makes a great product for record collectors, but they also offer free USA shipping on all orders of $50 or more. Plus, here's a 10% off coupon. Enter VinylGuide10 at checkout and enjoy a 10% discount on a great product. That's groovewasher.com. 10% off with checkout code VinylGuide10. Groovewasher.com, proud to be made in the USA.
Hello, this is Matt Cameron from Soundgarden and Pearl Jam, and you're listening to The Vinyl Guide with Nate Goyer.
Do you listen to and collect vinyl records? Well, you're in luck. Welcome to The Vinyl Guide, the podcast made for record nerds like yourself. Here's your host, the biggest record nerd of them all, Nate Goyer.
Well, hey everyone. Greetings, salutations, and how's it hanging? This is Nate, host of The Vinyl Guide. Enjoying another week in paradise. We're here in lockdown, just like the rest of y'all. Not the greatest week, but certainly not the worst. I'm sure we'll get through this, and I think we're finally starting to see some light at the end of the tunnel, especially here in Australia. For those of you who haven't seen or read this yet, I put up a blog post earlier this week on what I believe the music scene will be like after the COVID-19 lockdowns are relaxed. Now, it won't go immediately back to normal. In fact, it'll be quite some time before we can, again, attend large concerts, stadiums, and arena-level gatherings. They're still a year or so away. And certainly international tours are kaput for the moment due to cost-prohibitive air travel and international quarantine regulations. Look, I wrote all about it on a blog post at thevinylguide.com. Go over and have a read of it and comment on it, even share it. But overall, I think the key to exiting the lockdown successfully with the music and vinyl culture intact is to focus on the local scenes. Small gatherings are going to be allowed months and months, maybe years, before large gatherings are again allowed. So this is a great opportunity for you small bands to get good and build a fan base and tour around your countries, giving people much needed entertainment, playing pubs and clubs, gatherings of 50 to 100 people. And likewise, I believe music and record stores can definitely stay with us. They absolutely have a role to play, although again, they will strongly benefit from a local focus. Hosting bands, carrying local band merch, incubating and cultivating a cultural scene. Again, this whole post is on thevinylguide.com. Feel free to read it, share it, comment, or whatever. Just my predictions, people, but certainly something to think about. What else are you doing today, huh? All right, well, let's get into this week's episode because I'm absolutely thrilled to be sharing an interview I recently had with Matt Cameron, drummer of Soundgarden, Pearl Jam, and heaps more. Matt is a busy, busy, busy guy, and he's got a hell of a work ethic. He's got focus, he's got charm, and of course, he's got the skills to navigate the finicky world of rock and roll and play for not only one legendary band, but two, plus a heap of other side projects and solo works that we'll also discuss today. Now, Matt's been quite busy. He's recently recorded and released a track, Down the Middle, with Buzz Osborne and Steve McDonald of Melvins, as well as Toshi Kasai as the producer. So, effectively, it's three quarters Melvins plus Matt. That track is available to listen to and download at mattcameron1.bandcamp.com. I'll put the link in this episode page, and this is just a taster for the EP or perhaps album that Matt is currently working on to be released at some point in the future with other members of Melvins and more. So again, mattcameron1.bandcamp.com. The track is called Down the Middle. Check it out. Now, before we start off, just a few notes here. First off, huge thanks to Matt Kessler, the very handsome host of the YouTube channel Too Many Records for giving me some Pearl Jam vinyl facts. Now, Matt is an absolute PJ nut, so I was fortunate to have a shepherd such as himself going into this. Matt gave me some great pointers, so again, huge thanks, Matt, and everyone go check out the YouTube channel Too Many Records. Now, also, if you like this interview, you may also enjoy some of our other episodes given out freely and copiously at thevinylguide.com, including Episode 212, Toshi Kasai and the Art of Music Production. Now, Toshi and Matt Cameron worked together on Toshi's side project, Plan D, and now Matt's Down the Middle track, which we're talking about today, he worked on at Toshi's studio. So let's hear from Toshi Kasai on Episode 212 of The Vinyl Guide. Also, you could check out Episode 206, featuring Bruce Pavitt, founder of Sub Pop. We talk about vinyl, we talk about grunge, lots of Seattle scene stories in there. That's episode 206 of The Vinyl Guide. Episode 182 of The Vinyl Guide features Jellyfish and Beck keyboardist extraordinaire Roger Joseph Manning Jr. Episode 164 of The Vinyl Guide features Dimitri Coates of Off. Episode 156 features Cody Willis of Big Business, Melvins, and more. Chuck Dukowski of Black Flag. Episode 145. So many other episodes to mention. Check them out at thevinylguide.com. All interviews and episodes can be heard anytime on Spotify, Apple Music, or wherever you get your podcasts. So now we are done with the upfronts. Let's talk to Matt Cameron. Today on The Vinyl Guide, we have Matt Cameron, drummer, musician, songwriter, part-time vocalist. I think that's fair, Matt. High achiever, record mogul. What else am I missing here? World Jiu-Jitsu champion.
Record mogul.
Yeah.
I tried and failed at that.
Okay.
Endeavor.
Let me just go through your resume here. 12-time Michelin star chef. First man to climb Mount Everest in a Speedo. So look, I think it's fair. You are quite the high achiever, Matt. Plus you drum for a couple of wonderful bands, Soundgarden and Pearl Jam. So first off, Matt, are you into vinyl records?
Well, yeah. I mean, probably not as much as I was when I was growing up, because that was the main way that we all heard our favorite bands and our favorite music. And then I recently, you know, once the CD kind of era hit, the early MP3 era, I didn't really buy as much, but then it made such a massive resurgence in, you know, what, the early 2000s or, you know, 2005-ish or something like that, where the, you know, the quality and like the reissues are what really got me back into it.
Okay. And have you found yourself like going out and recollecting all those records you got rid of in the 90s?
Yeah, for sure. Well, I mean, mostly like jazz records that I really loved growing up. So, and there's a lot of really great stuff out there in the jazz world and in the rock world, for sure.
And what are some of the early records that you had that really changed your life?
Yeah, well, you know, When I was about, I must have been like, you know, 8 or 10, there was a couple kids on the street where we lived in Chula Vista, a suburb of San Diego. And this one kid had, I remember he had, you know, I was trying to remember my original trade. It was like, the first record that blew my mind was Jimi Hendrix Smash Hits. And that was, that was probably, you know, 1970 or something like that. So I was, you know, I was about eight or nine. But I think I traded one of my records for Smash Hits. And I think the record I traded, if I remember it right, was Rick Derringer All-American Boy. That had Rock and Roll Hoochie Coo on it. I think Edgar Winter played on it and stuff. But the song Rock and Roll Hoochie Coo was big for me growing up. Smash Hits. And then, you know, I have an older sister who had a really good record collection, and she collected kind of more like the, some of the soft rock stuff of the day, but stuff I still really enjoyed, like Deja Vu by Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, Joni Mitchell, Blue. And then my dad had really good jazz collection, but he was more into like, Count Basie, Tommy Dorsey type stuff. Benny Goodman, the more big band stuff, but he had a Dave Brubeck record. I think it was called Live at Oberlin. It's a pretty famous Dave Brubeck record. So I remember listening to that a lot as well. So yeah, there's records in my young life, definitely pre-teen years, that made like pretty major impacts. That I remember to this day.
So I would imagine, as wonderful it is, Joni Mitchell probably didn't inspire you to play drums as much as some of the jazz records. Would that be fair?
Well, you know what? Well, I think that the rock records are the ones that really got me going at a young age, like, Kiss, David Bowie, Deep Purple. The jazz thing came into my development or my awareness at around age 17, 18. So the early teen, preteen years were all, Kiss, Aerosmith, Cheap Trick, like the FM rock that was on the radio at that time in America.
Confirm or deny this for me. Is it true that you received a cease and desist order from Kiss when you were 13?
Well, I was 14. Okay, well, yeah, that's another part of my darkened past. I played a Kiss cover band when I was 14 with some kids that lived in the neighborhood where I grew up, and we were obsessed with Kiss. We were just totally into it. And so we formed a Kiss cover band for our, the local high school talent show. And I was still in junior high when I was playing in bands with all these older kids. And then Gene somehow found out about us, and we were just some podunk local band in Chula Vista. Kiss imitation band, but I guess at that time they were going after the Kiss cover bands. And we were really into the Kiss record covers, and we studied all the logos and all the information on them. And so when the kid that played Paul Stanley, he received the I don't know how they got their address, but he received the Aucoin management letterhead from their manager with the cease and desist. So we thought it was so cool that we got a letter from Aucoin management.
But that is so on brand for them, really.
Exactly. They were coming after 14-year-old kids at that time.
I'm surprised they didn't try to make you a deal, for 14% of your band.
You will be an indentured servant for the rest of your life. Sign here, please. Yeah.
Matt Cameron, you are now property of Kiss Incorporated and Aucoin Management.
Yeah. Oh, no, of Gene Simmons, probably.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Rights would transfer to Gene after a period of 14 years.
No, but I loved Kiss growing up, and, hey. It was they were a massive influence on American youth in 1976.
Oh, absolutely! And going back to when you were drumming and you're in your early teens, you heard these records. You decided to go for drums. You seem to really study it very, very hard. It sounds like you put a lot of time into it. A very strong work ethic.
I did.
Where did you get that?
Well, my dad. Made sure that we all had jobs in this, summer jobs when we turned 15, that was probably part of it. Mm-hmm. But I was really just bitten by the music bug, I guess, from listening to all these amazing records, amazing musicians and bands that were, sort of popular at the time or, not as popular, but it turns out we're all like just amazing records that hold up to this day, I mean, Jimi Hendrix smash hits. Like, if that's your first record, then you're going to be okay.
Yeah.
I think I just really, once I figured out how to play the drums, which I could do at a pretty young age, and I had other interests too, like motocross and surfing and fun kind of Southern California activities. I just felt like so empowered when I was able to, you know, pull off a new technique or just kind of feel more comfortable on the drum set and everything. And that just came through my, I guess my, you know, my natural abilities, but also my desire to, you know, to learn more. But I was just fully turned on to this music that I was listening to as well. Mm-hmm. And that had something to do with it.
Well, was it always really from the beginning you wanted to make your career in music, or did you have a backup plan? What were your thoughts about where it lead you?
Yeah, I didn't really think of a music career per se. It was just more about something that I really had become attached to. And I felt like, you know, it gave me a voice somehow, because I was a pretty like shy kid. I didn't really have, you know, I wasn't like an athlete, or, you know, I didn't play organized sports. I did stuff on my own, I should say. So I never really like knew how to pursue it if I was going to. It's like, you know, how do you become, you know, how do you become super successful or whatever, playing in a rock band? That didn't really enter my mind as much as like, okay, I'm playing gigs, you know, I can pay my rent. You know, at some point I was able to do that, and I was just like, fuck, this is cool. You know, I'll learn how to live with very little and play as much music as I can to pay the rent. And I still had to, you know, work tons of day jobs and stuff.
Yeah.
But I was into the balance of it all. I felt like, you know, as long as I can play music and I can focus completely on that, I can deal with all the, you know, all the other stuff that will allow me to do that.
And it sounds like you have a very practical, pragmatic approach, and probably credit your father for giving you that foundation. Was moving from San Diego to Seattle, was that a bit of a moonshot? Like, what was the logic behind moving out of that?
Total moonshot. Yeah. I just knew at that time I was 20. That I didn't want to live in my hometown anymore. I wanted to go somewhere else. But what the trip started out as pretty much a visit to one of my good friends that had moved to Seattle that I played in a band with in San Diego. He just invited me up to, you know, kind of jam with his new band, and, you know, I could stay at his parents' house. And, I mean, that was it. It was just to kind of go up and visit my friend in Seattle. And he's the only one I knew at the time. So that was 1983.
And what were your expectations from it?
None. I had no expectations. I just knew that I knew this one guy that I really connected with musically. And that was pretty much it. You know, I was going to get a job, and we were going to, you know, try to get a house and all that kind of stuff. But I went up with one other guy from San Diego, a bass player friend of mine, and he lasted about like 4 weeks, because, you know, it was like we came up in February, you know, raining every single day, dark, no sun, you know, moldy basement houses. But I kind of dug it because it was just like so completely different from how I grew up. But my buddy was like, "Oh, I gotta get out of here. I gotta get back to the sunshine."
So you entrench yourself in the Seattle scene. Were you very quickly engaged in music bands and playing live there? How long did it take you to kind of become to get in that?
Pretty much, man. I started playing gigs with my friend Glenn Slater, who I moved up to Seattle with, and we played at all the clubs that, you know, all the early grunge bands played at. And it was a really small but very well connected scene of musicians and bands. I kind of plugged right in. I met all my people, like, you know, in the mid 80s pretty much, that I would go on to, you know, form Soundgarden with and play in Pearl Jam, and then all the other music projects that I did in Seattle. Yeah. But when I first came up here, I was like, I got a job at, this pizza parlor, and the bass player from the Farts, which were a really seminal punk band in the, you know, late 70s, early 80s in Seattle. You know, I worked with him in the kitchen. So he, you know, he kind of turned me on to kind of the early punk scene, you know, the Accused, Farts, Blackouts, There were some incredible bands up here at that time. And then there was also some kind of more commercial 80s rock bands that seemed like they were poised to become commercially successful. There's this band called The Moving Targets that I remember really liking. So there was like a very diverse music scene that seemed like really, really focused on original material. So that's the one thing that I really like was blown away by in Seattle, because the bands I played with in San Diego were mostly cover bands, you know. But going through that experience of playing in cover bands, I played tons of gigs. By the time I got to Seattle, I was kind of I played in like 15 bands or something, you know.
Well, that's how you cut your teeth in doing it live. I mean, that's what the Beatles did. They went to Hamburg and played, you know, 12 hours a day covers. You know, that's how they learned what their idols were doing, the tricks of songwriting, and then make them their own.
Absolutely, yeah.
So the Seattle scene, I always picture it as a tight knit community. But like, how close were you to like the guys of Nirvana, Mother Love Bone, Tad, and such?
Well, I mean, I was close to pretty much all those bands, but the Nirvana guys didn't live in Seattle, so we didn't see them as much, like in the, you know, mid 80s. There was a handful of clubs, and there was a handful of building spaces that all of our bands would play at. You know, there was definitely kind of a punk scene. Some different factions of the local music scene at that time in the mid 80s, but like there was kind of a, you know, kind of like some hardcore punk stuff. And then there was some more like poppy new wave stuff, a lot of really cool avant-garde stuff. You know, like groups that would like have dancing and like, you know, art. It was like a really weirdo kind of art scene along with the, you know, like along with the rock bands that it became known for.
What was it, competitive, like early Soundgarden gigs, Tad playing the same night, or was it more camaraderie?
No, it was more camaraderie for sure. You know, that's how I definitely saw it. And I've heard horror stories about, you know, when Duff moved down to L.A., like, you know, he came from this sort of like, you know, really inclusive kind of tight-knit community to cutthroat fucking, you know, slice your wrist, Hollywood rock, you know, the rock world. Right. So yeah, I think that the Seattle scene at that time was not really that competitive, but I think we were all trying to, I don't know, like maybe like one up each other a little bit with our releases. And I mean, I definitely felt like all the bands were really like unique and different, the ones that became well known. But I think, you know, I think if there was competition, it was just like on a musical level.
Was Soundgarden playing live before you joined? Were you familiar with them before you became a member?
Oh, okay. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I saw those guys I saw them play, well, I mean, my Soundgarden story. Are you ready?
Sure, let's do it.
well, I was playing in a trio in 1984, I guess it was, with Jack... Daniel House, who I eventually played in Skin Yard with, and a guitar player friend of ours named Tom Nurm. And we played at a pizza parlor called Morningtown Pizza in the U District, and I think it was like 84. And there was another band playing with us called the Shemps. And the Shemps included Hiro Yamamoto, Kim Thiel, and Chris Cornell, and a drummer named Matt Dentino. And so that was the first time I heard those guys play together, and we met at that gig. And I think they played covers. They were like a cover band, but Chris was probably 19 at the time. And, you know, he was incredible. His voice was huge, tons of presence, super fun to watch. They played before us. And then when we played, Chris hung out and watched me intently as I was drumming. So that's how we first met.
And how long was it between then and the time that you actually joined the band?
I joined in 1986. In 1984, they started playing as a trio, Chris drumming and singing. And then they got a drummer in 1985, Scott Sundquist. And they played a lot in Seattle at that time. And that's when I first saw them. and I thought they were amazing. They were my favorite local band for sure. So when their drummer quit, you know, the news spread that Soundgarden was looking for a drummer. And so I called Kim up at the time, who was my neighbor. And I said, Kim, you know, let me in. And he was like, yeah, okay, yeah, we want you, you know. So they saw me playing Skin Yard and other bands and stuff. So I wasn't like an unknown commodity to those guys.
Oh, that's right. You were in Skin Yard. So you guys were part of that Deep Six compilation.
That's right. That's right. Yeah.
Okay.
That was the first time that I heard the Melvins and met all those guys as well.
Is that your first appearance on vinyl, that Deep Six compilation?
No, I did one stupid single in San Diego with this really, really bad, sappy single. But that's kind of my first release in Seattle. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Let's talk about that sappy single. What is it?
No, let's not.
It's something you're keen to leave in the rearview mirror.
Well, let's just say it's in a box in storage.
Oh, you just made the collectors faint. You know that, right?
you're gonna have to dig through a lot of stuff to find it. But that was my first Seattle proper Seattle release, and I think that was '85.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Was it under Matt Cameron? What was the band under? The name?
No, yeah. Well, it was Skin Yard, and we did two songs. Yeah. So it's me, and the Skin Yard guys. Ben McMillan, Daniel House, Jack and Dino.
Oh no, I know the Deep Six record. I'm talking the sappy one.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, the sappy record is buried away very deep.
Oh boy, okay.
Everyone, where it shall remain.
Look for it on Storage Wars 2050.
There you go.
Okay. I'm going to come back to that. So so once you joined Soundgarden, there was a Sub Pop single, I believe the first Soundgarden, Hunted Down, Nothing to Say, which is actually one of the more collectible Sub Pop singles there. It's a translucent blue vinyl. Tell us the story behind that record.
Oh yeah. Well, the blue single was our first release on Sub Pop that came out before the Screaming Life EP, and I believe that was 1987. Mm-hmm. And we recorded everything with Jack and Dino at Reciprocal, like, you know, in, I don't know, two or three day period. Bruce and John from Sub Pop wanted to put out 7-inch before the EP. That's kind of how they did the Green River record and, you know, all the subsequent records at that time. So that was sort of standard procedure with those guys. And doing the colored vinyl was one of their specialties, you know. I thought that was really cool.
Bruce Pavitt was on the show. He mentioned that they were putting them just in boxes to record stores just to kind of get the hype up. Was that your memory, or do you remember selling them at shows? Were they in stores at all?
No, I remember the it was mostly for promo and for, you know, just to get the buzz going about the bands. We would take, God, I don't know if we took the singles out. I think we used to take we did an EP after Screaming Life, the FOP EP. And I remember taking that one out on the road and the Screaming Life EP, but I don't remember taking the 7-inch out on the road.
And Screaming Life came out not long after the single. There was the orange vinyl collectible version. Are these all records that, you know, the band got their own box? Do you still have some of those?
I do, absolutely.
What was the reason for going from Sub Pop to SST for Ultra Mega OK?
Well, we were huge fans of Black Flag and Meat Puppets, Husker Du, all the bands that we were listening to at the time. And bands that the Soundgarden guys actually, you know, really turned me on to, because I really wasn't listening to that stuff in San Diego. But once I came up here and met all those guys, they definitely turned me on to the SST and, you know, all the different labels around the States at that time. But we loved the label, and we just thought it would be a great ramp up for us, I guess, from Sub Pop. I think we wanted to get out of the whole Sub Pop world and just try something different. And luckily, Greg and Chuck were into the band. You know, I think we were probably the most, like, you know, metal type commercial rock metal band for SST at that time. Not totally commercial, but like compared to what was on SST at that time. So I think it was kind of a leap of faith for them to take us on, but we were really excited to be there.
It sounds like it may have been a leap of faith for yourselves as well. I would imagine with Sub Pop being local, you're able to look at people in the eyes and kind of deal with them. And then all of a sudden you're dealing with a record label that's really on the other side of the country, as far as you're concerned, in, you know, Pacific Northwest. So were there growing pains? Were there challenges with that?
Yeah, I mean, it was just kind of a one record deal, but we were also in talks with A&M at that time. Hmm. So we were sort of ramping up our relationship with the A&M deal that was coming around the corner. So we also looked at the SST experience as something that would give us more bargaining power, you know, once we got to a major label, which, you know, I think early on we got a major label interest, like, you know, in 1986, pretty much, you know, like it was sort of something that we felt like it would be fun to pursue, like at a later date after we, you know, got a bunch of touring under our belts and, you know, some independent records under our belts as well. So, so that was going on at the same time.
That's a real mature way of looking at things, especially for a young band, because at that point, you know, people wanted to get signed. They wanted to be touring.
Oh, yeah.
But you guys, it seemed like you had an appreciation for the organic growth.
Kim Thiel and Hiro Yamamoto were very influential in that decision. They there was definitely some conversations about how to pursue that that transition, but in hindsight, it was the right move.
Was Soundgarden a true democracy at that point?
Absolutely, yeah. We really were, man. Mm-hmm. Everyone had a voice, you know, and everyone had pretty strong opinions. I didn't have as strong a personality as those guys do, you know. It was a band of extremely strong-headed people. So I sometimes was like the leveler or the guy that would like try to pursue the path of least resistance, you know. I was that guy. But
the peacemaker.
Yeah. But everyone had a very big voice in the band.
And now, as you guys are leaving SST, you're on A&M, Louder Than Love comes out, and then Nirvana really starts to break. What was the view of the band when they saw Nirvana really taking off and changing the music industry?
Well, I think we were really excited for them. I mean, they made such an amazing record. You know, but at the same time, we just put out Bad Motorfinger, so we were feeling really good about our record too. Mm-hmm. And I felt there was so many good records that came out in '91, so we felt like it was just part of this sea change in the rock world. But yeah, they blew up so quickly that, you know, looking at them from a distance, you know, like I was able to do, I was like, ooh, that's a little too much, you know. It's like I love the music and I love the band and everything, but it's just like, well, I'm glad that we're not on that that trajectory.
In a world now where everyone's looking at data and flattening curves and things like that, Nirvana really seems to be that high spike and that quick descent.
Oh my God.
Yeah, where Soundgarden's had this long career and this beautiful arc of creativity. So did life change significantly at that point?
You know what? It changed for me a little bit financially, but the workload was still the same. I mean, I was still just working my dick off, you know, on tour all the time, making records and writing songs, you know, and happy to do it, man. I was like, I wanted to be there. Mm-hmm. We all did, but there was a pretty huge burnout factor that was, you know, looking back on it now, it's like, yeah, we worked our asses off, you know. Mm-hmm. Luckily we were young enough to do that and able-bodied to do it. But no, it didn't like significantly change my life. I mean, cause I've always been a musician, and so I was just happy that I got to keep playing music in a band that I totally loved.
Mm-hmm. So 1997, Soundgarden decides to call it quits. a bit of a gulf between then and when you joined Pearl Jam. What were your thoughts about your career at that point? Were you nervous?
No, not at all. The only thing I was nervous about is my longtime girlfriend and I got married and we started a family. So I was just worried about, you know, putting food on the table, and just like transitioning into a more responsible, you know, parental role, you know, breadwinner role. Mm-hmm. But at the time, when Soundgarden broke up, I had about a year, maybe like 10 months to just kind of mess around. And it was pretty awesome. I made a Wellwater Conspiracy record with John McBain. So essentially I kind of went right back into my, you know, quote unquote solo music life, at that point. And I felt like I'd find some gigs that, you know, I'd find some kind of gig to drum on. And I started working with Josh Homme at that time. John McBain and I kind of helped him start Queens, you know, like he was getting that whole Queens of the Stone Age thing started. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, I just did a lot of writing and just hanging out.
Yeah. You seem to be, again, like a guy who doesn't rest much. I mean, you're constantly going. I think at one point you were doing a solo album with Geddy Lee as well. So that must have been a bit of a, what was the pressure like working with Geddy, who, you know, he's a guy who spent his career with Neil Peart behind him. I mean, how was stepping into that role?
It was a little nerve-wracking, you know, like before I actually met him. When I met him, he put my mind to rest. And once I heard the music and, you know, kind of was able to dig into what he and his producer Ben Mink wanted, I wasn't nervous at all. Like, I didn't really think about the whole Rush connection, you know. I just wanted to make sure that he was happy with what I brought to the table, you know, at that time. Mm-hmm. But, you know, but looking back on it now, it's like, yeah, that was a pretty heavy duty experience for me, for sure. And we're lifelong friends, man. We're like, mm-hmm. we're so tight. And when Neil unfortunately passed away, you know, we all the guys in Pearl Jam and Soundgarden reached out and gave Geddy and Alex a big old hug from Seattle. You know, we were all pretty crushed by the news.
So when you went to Pearl Jam, was there a difference in the camaraderie within the band, within Pearl Jam, than it was from Soundgarden? What was the difference in the dynamic there?
Well, you know, I think when you come into like an established thing like that, that's really successful, there's going to be, you know, there's going to be an established thing that you don't want to kind of come in and like try to upset or try to make it in a way that isn't naturally, that it's not naturally set up to be. But I knew all those guys for a long time. And like, so, you know, we were all friends and stuff, and they were so welcoming and warm, you know, from day one. And I think that it was and still is, it was a pretty easy transition for me in that sense, as far as the camaraderie, because it's really pro. I think I've been able to like kind of adapt to like super pro, efficient, well-oiled machine type of environments, like the PJ environment, you know.
How long did it take for you to no longer feel like the new guy?
Well, you know, it took a little while, because like originally I was kind of filling in for Jack Irons. Like, he kind of canceled on a tour late in the game, and so I got a frantic call from those guys. I'm like, hey, can you tour with us? And I was like, yeah, sure, you know. And then I had to go learn 100 songs, which I was able to do. I mean, it took a while for sure, but you know, it took a little bit of a transitional sort of period of time to feel like I was kind of making, like, they wanted me to be a permanent member. So I think for me, that means as a musician, I want to be able to contribute, you know, creatively, like I did in Soundgarden. Because, mm-hmm. like, my Soundgarden experience was such a complete experience, you know. It's like I had the fucking, everything was kind of working, was flowing for me as a musician and as an artist. It's like, it was just full immersion. So I think, like, you know, unfortunately, it's like I try to bring that mindset into Pearl Jam once they, you know, wanted me as a permanent member. And once I was able to, you know, collaborate with those guys creatively and, you know, bring music to the table and have them collaborate with me on it, then that's when it really kicked in. And that was pretty much the first studio album.
Now, each night, Pearl Jam has a new set list, custom for that show. Stepping into the drum position partway through their career, you had to catch up on all these songs and be ready at any moment to play those songs. How was it getting used to that process?
Well, you know, I think musically I was able to do it, but I'm not good at song titles. I've never been the best like lyric memorizer or song title memorizer. So I had to have, God bless him, Jeff Ament, the bass player, stand on the, you know, right next to me on the drum riser, sort of like, you know, conducting what the next song is going to be because I didn't recognize the title. That was the only real issue I had. But, you know, it's a lot of music and, you know, they've got certain ways of playing it, you know, like cues, live cues or certain things like that. I really had to be open to how they felt comfortable on stage. And once that became a better flow between all the band members, then it just became second nature.
Is it true that the song list typically comes from Eddie each night?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. How much advance notice? When do you get it? When do you get the paper?
It's pretty much the day of the gig. You know, like if we are there for a sound check, we'll run through a couple things. If not, then it's pretty much 3 or 4 hours before the show, something like that. Mm-hmm. And if there's a song that we don't remember, we will sit in the dressing room and listen to it. And, you know, I'll have a practice pad. And then we also have a little practice room at the gig as well. So, yeah. So we try to cover a lot on our tours. And Eddie will sort of cross-reference different set lists. Like, okay, did we play this song, you know, at this year at this particular city? If not, he'll, you know, try to switch it up. And so, yeah, he puts a lot of thought into it. And it's really fun for us to have a different set list every night. You know, sometimes Soundgarden wasn't as adventurous with the set lists in the 90s. And so when we did get back together in 2010, I asked Chris if it was okay if I became the set list guy. And so I took Eddie's way of doing the set list in the sense that, you know, I'd have certain like, you know, beginning and, you know, some middle stuff and maybe a couple ending songs, but the you know, the Soundgarden guys were just like, oh, this is so fun. Why didn't we always do this? You know, it's like, because we played the same set list the whole damn time. But yeah, I think it's fun for a band to be able to have enough material to mix it up like that.
And it's good that you're getting a few hours notice too. I pictured in my mind, maybe, you know, you're getting it with 20 minutes to think about.
Oh, no, no, no.
Okay.
No.
Now, I'm pretty clear Pearl Jam is a very vinyl-friendly band, and that's been proven over and over and over again. What are the conversations like in Pearl Jam around the product on vinyl?
Well, I think, you know, we've always made an effort to put it out on vinyl. Jeff Ament is normally the guy that does all the packaging and art, you know, art direction. Mm-hmm. So I think there's always a mindset of making sure the art's going to look good on a big canvas like that you get with vinyl. But I think, you know, we always want to present the music and in that type of package.
Is that generally the final state? Like, you know, it's not, a CD is handy, but does the band really try, like vinyl is that desired end state of the music? Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
We all grew up on vinyl. You know, we all still buy vinyl. Mike has a vinyl only record label, you know? So yeah, we're totally into it.
And there's a lot of rare pressings and variants, that sort of thing. So I'm assuming as band members, you guys have your own personal collections of a lot of this rare Pearl Jam stuff, yeah?
I have copies of all of the 10 Club singles that we did, like in the 2000s, mm-hmm, up to present day. Yeah, and I've got, you know, I have some of the singles and stuff, but do you mean like bootleg stuff?
Well, I'm assuming you have all the all the official releases. There's promos, there's colored copies,
variants. I don't have all of that stuff, but it's on file somewhere. We have a warehouse that I'm sure it's in there. But I have all the studio releases and the 10 club singles.
The conversations around the band in terms of some of the rare releases. And are you familiar with the Benaroya Hall Pearl Jam release?
Oh yeah.
Okay.
I played it. I was there.
I'm sure you were. That one drives collectors pretty mad pretty insane because, well, there were limited number. I think there was about 2,000, but prices of
check this out, collectors. Okay. I now remember that I have a signed copy in the same storage space that I have my first sappy single at. So Storage Wars, my unit's going to be going off.
Believe me, I'm going to be right there in the front row with that annoying Dave Hester guy. Yep. 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 So that Benaroya Hall box set fetches around $3,000 to $4,000 just for that.
Oh my God.
Set.
Wow.
And that's just one of probably a couple dozen Pearl Jam vinyl releases that go for a lot of money on the collector's market. I'm assuming the band is aware of a lot of that the hype around it. Yeah.
I suppose. Yeah. I mean, I'm not that aware of it. I don't really pay that much attention to it, but, I think it's all released to sort of create that type of fan connection. You know, I think we really have a lot of fans that love collecting that kind of stuff.
And PJ seems to absolutely cater to that sort of desire, Have you ever been to pjcollectors.com? All the Pearl Jam stuff is there. It's all these rare demos and reissues and that sort of thing. So,
oh, cool.
When you got together with back with Soundgarden, as I understand it, originally it was not to reunite musically, but more just to protect the legacy. There weren't websites around.
Right. Yeah, we had figured, you know, let's see if we can all get together and talk about our catalog and, you know, if we can get another merch deal. And that was kind of why we originally started talking. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And once the conversation started talking towards getting back together, touring, even recording, what was the balance like with Pearl Jam? Was there ever a time where you thought you may have had to choose one or the other?
I tried to keep them both going at the same time. Mm-hmm. I felt like, I had to bring up all my reserves in strength and try to keep it going as long as I could. You know, I had a young family as well at home that definitely needed me. So it did throw my home life into a little bit of a tizzy in the sense that, like, I was kind of working as much as I did in the early 90s. And I knew that I would get there, I knew that the schedule would get that filled, but there was one tour that I had to get a sub for the Soundgarden commitment. So I was going to try to keep it going like that, where I'd sort of pick and choose if I could, like, get a sub for one band or the other. And, you know, that was how I thought I would try to do it.
So there were a few times where there was a clear clash and you had a plan on how to deal with that. Okay.
Yeah. There was like the one, I think it was 2014. I had to get a sub for the Soundgarden, part of it. Right. And also they were going on a 8-week tour or something. I was just like, man, I do not want to go on an 8-week tour right now. So, I had like a 5-week tour, booked in that 8 weeks. Mm-hmm. But then I played two shows with them on that tour. I kind of flew in and out and stuff. So it was great though. I mean, any chance to get to play with Soundgarden, I was just like, yeah. Let's do it.
And as testament to your work ethic, not only did you have Soundgarden going and Pearl Jam, but then you took time to do a solo album, Cave Dweller.
Yeah. Well, Cave Dweller, I was working on, I was kind of writing songs and like I wrote a whole bunch of songs that I felt were could make an album in 2016. And, you know, also at that time, the Temple of the Dog reunion tour happened.
Oh, jeez.
So I write a lot of music here at home. And so I felt like I had a good batch of songs. And I contacted an incredible drummer that I have respect for, Mark Chiana, and Tim Lefebvre, a bass player who I had first heard on the David Bowie Black Star album. So I contacted those guys through Facebook, I think, and I asked, hey, do you want to record some songs for a solo album? And luckily they said yes, and we kind of did it remotely, and I flew out to New York City to record with Mark for a couple days. So that came together like fairly quickly. It wasn't like a big schedule situation for me.
We've also heard you recently on Toshi's solo project Plan D.
Yeah.
And I think you have some other stuff going on as well. What are your current projects, Matt?
Yeah. I've been writing a whole bunch of stuff for another solo album. And I wanted to try to work with some different musicians on it. So I asked the Melvins, if they would record some of this music that I wrote. And so, yeah, I went down to Toshi's studio, Melvins HQ, in spring of last year, and recorded a whole bunch of stuff. And I would love to work more with those guys. They were incredible to work with. Yeah, working with Buzz was really awesome, man. He's a machine. he can play anything you throw at him. And I was like, it was great.
So you envision more work there with Buzz and the community. How far through this next solo project do you think you are right now?
You know, I think I've got about 7 good songs. So I definitely got a good EP in me right now. Buzz and I have been talking about releasing a 4-song EP. I don't know if we can do it right now, but that's the plan right now. And then I'll kind of finish up some more songs and put out a proper, maybe 7 or 8 song album.
Right now, Pearl Jam is supposed to be touring, but obviously the whole world hit the brakes. How are you spending your free time? How are you filling the days?
I'm staying at home as much as possible with my family. My kids are going a little stir crazy. One thing that we're trying to do together is cook meals, and we're watching movies. We get set up a little screen. We're figured out how to make the Netflix work on a big screen. It's hanging out. I have a 90-year-old mom I'm looking after, so we're just I've got some responsibilities right now that I'm taking care of, but it's just a lot of hanging out.
Yeah.
And, I'm also I've got a little home studio here as well. So, it's not that much different than how I normally spend my time if I'm not busy with my family or not on the road. It's like I love just being in my studio and working on music, by myself, or I'll have a couple friends over or something. So in a weird kind of way, nothing's changed too much other than the world kind of falling apart.
Well, you've got some unexpected time on your hands. I would imagine, and I know if you think differently, I think, and not just yourself, but I think a lot of artists are going to exit out of this, self-isolation period with a lot to say and a lot of really interesting art on the other side of this.
Or a different way to look at how you approach your art. There's going to be new means of getting your art out there, I think you're right. It is going to sort of flip the switch on how we think about it all. One thing I did do is I just made a little video of a new song that I recorded with the Melvins that I put on my Instagram page. And, I made a YouTube channel and I started a Bandcamp page. I have a TuneCore page as well. So I'm trying to, stay productive but not too productive. I don't want to put all my time into this because I've got some children that need some emotional support as well.
Of course. All right. So where can people hear this new stuff, Matt? You said you have a Bandcamp account.
Yeah. You know what? Yeah, I only have one song on Bandcamp right now under the Matt Cameron Bandcamp account, and it should be on streaming here in a couple days. The single's called "Down the Middle," and it's one of the songs I recorded with the Melvins.
Oh, "Down the Middle." Okay, well this episode's probably going to go out in another week or two, so it may be available by then. Yeah,
absolutely.
So you're spending your spare time marketing.
Exactly. In the digital world, something I never do. I'm a terrible self-promoter.
I don't think you're giving yourself enough credit there. You know, if you would sell some of those sappy records that you have in the storage unit, maybe you'll. All right. I'll put the links to the Bandcamp and, of course, to the Instagram here on the episode page. Any other vinyl stuff? Any other vinyl stories? I get the impression you've got a fair amount of PJ vinyl, a fair amount of collectible stuff, but you don't really pay attention to that sort of stuff. You kind of file it and forget it and move to the next project.
I kind of do. You know, I have a little stack of vinyl like here in my studio, and I could talk about this one thing. Let's see here. So I played with Kim and I played with the MC50. Wayne Kramer MC5. It was the 50th anniversary of Kick Out the Jams in 2018, excuse me. And we recorded a live show at Third Man Records in October. Yeah, it was Halloween 2018 and 50th anniversary of when they recorded, you know, the original Kick Out the Jams. And we recorded this at Third Man in Detroit, and they made it really cool, double vinyl, you know, blue double vinyl release out of that. And I think Third Man Records is definitely needs to get a shout out as far as, keeping this culture alive and putting so much energy into the art of, you know, making the record.
Absolutely.
So there you go.
In fact, I believe Cave Dweller was pressed through Monkey Ranch at Third Man. So I can tell
And that was per my request. When I took a tour of the Detroit pressing plant in 2017, and I was super impressed with the the quality of how they set their press up, and they were really on it. So I knew that if I did more solo work or whatever, I'd definitely go through those guys.
And I would imagine Monkey Wrench is that's kind of the Faw Pearl Jam label. Is that fair to characterize it that way? Okay.
That's right. Yeah.
And most of their pressing is done at Third Man. So that's where I could really tell that, they really care about vinyl. Like who runs Monkey Wrench?
Well, it's a combination of our manager, Kelly Curtis. Tim Bierman is heavily involved. He also runs a 10 club. So yeah, it's just, and then, you know, Jeff and Eddie and Stone and myself, you know, it's like, I think, it's definitely like a labor of love for everyone, for sure.
I would imagine it is. It's a place where any Pearl Jam member who has a side project, it's a vehicle, it's a lane that they could release it. So that's very fair. All right, well, Matt, thank you so much for coming on The Vinyl Guide. We do appreciate you you sharing all those stories and running through that history, both vinyl and not. You've had an amazing life, man.
Thank you, man.
The one thing that's really just striking me is how disciplined, how focused you are, and I think that's really a lesson that I'm trying to teach my kids that I think everyone can learn from, is just, you know, find what you love and work your ass off, and good stuff will happen, right? I mean, you know, if you put your heart into it and you put your sweat behind it, then you'll have a good life. So I'll be putting the links up on our episode page to Matt's new work, as well as links to where you can pick up copies of Cave Dweller on vinyl. I'll also be linking pjcollectors.com, where you can look at all the astronomical prices that are being asked for things up there. And again, Matt, thank you so much for coming on the show, mate.
All right. Thank you, Nate. Really appreciate it.
No worries. All right. right, there we go, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Matt Cameron. What a gentleman. What a hard-working dude as well, I tell you. You know, he really put himself out there. I mean, there's a reason why he's been in two legendary bands, plus all the solo albums and side projects. He's a hard-working dude. He knows what he likes. He works at it. He puts in his sweat, his time, his 10,000 hours. And, man, what a fantastic career. What an amazing life. So, again, Matt, thank you so much for coming on and sharing those stories with us. Again, everyone, check out the track Down the Middle. It's Three Quarters Melvins. It's available at mattcameron1.bandcamp.com. Sign up. I think you could download it there. And I think this is, again, just a taster for the EP or album or whatever comes next. Anyway, thanks again, Matt. I'll put these links in the episode page. Alrighty, and that's it for this week's episode of The Vinyl Guide. Thank you so much for tuning in. You know, we have a Patreon page. You can become a patron of this podcast at patreon.com/vinylguide. A few bucks a month chucked our way towards your buddy Nate. Get you all sorts of early access to episodes, secret episodes, extended interviews, and more. That's patreon.com/vinylguide. If you are strapped in this environment, and I understand a lot of you are, and it's not easy for everyone, especially in this COVID times, you can't contribute, then please share these episodes. Put them out on your Twitter, tweet them out, share them on Facebook, Instagram, whatever. That is free, and it's a huge help to me. So, again, please share if you can. Join our Patreon page if you're blessed. And we'll be back shortly with a brand new episode. So until we talk next time, keep spinning. Cheers.
That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Send your thoughts to Nate at thevinylguide.com or follow or tag us on Instagram at Vinyl Guide. Until next time, keep spinning.